Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. The Bureau of Land Management is responsible for coal on federal lands. That coal makes up about 40% of total coal production in the U.S. Of the 314 existing federal coal leases, nearly a quarter of the leases are in Wyoming's Powder River Basin. Companies acquire these leases by bidding on the right to mine the federal coal. It has generated a lot of income, which the federal government splits with states. But Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Jorov reports that not everyone thinks the program is working as it should and that the government might be losing out on money.
The American people own the about 570 million acres of coal in the U.S., and it is the Bureau of Land Management that administers the leasing of that coal. The current coal leasing program is supposed to ensure that the federal government gets a fair return on this one-time use resource. But director of the Natural Resources Law Center at the University of Colorado Law School, Mark Squillaci, says the program is broken. Leases are now drawn up through a process that was initially supposed to be the exception.
Instead of the government sort of deciding how much coal to lease and how the tract should look to sort of maximize the return to the government, the coal company makes those decisions. They design the tracts, they decide how much coal they're going to lease. The government can change the application when it comes in. It rarely does in any significant way. And then the government just basically acts on the application.
That process is called lease by application, or LBA. In the LBA system, sales are rarely competitive, which presumably affects prices.
Since 1991, we've never had three bids on any lease tract, and in most cases, the vast majority of cases, only one bidder.
The companies bid against the BLM, which goes through a secret process to determine the fair market value for the coal. Even with the lack of competition, the BLM says it does not accept bids below fair market value. To determine that value, the agency looks at a slew of factors like the quality of the coal, the market, but especially other local sales as a comparison. Squillaci says it doesn't make sense for the BLM to look at its own local sale prices when the market extends nationwide.
The problem with that is they're all their own past sales, essentially, and arguably all well below what it looks like the market can bear.
Financial analyst for the Institute of Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, Tom Sanzillo, says it is possible to set fair market value even without competition.
You push the upper limits. You set higher prices, and you see how far the companies are going to go. It's a tough, tough negotiation to take place, but it's one that ultimately the United States taxpayer needs.
Wyoming branch chief of BLM Solid Minerals, Brendan Newman, says the BLM does not do that.
We don't have the need to. I mean, this is what we believe is the fair market value. This is the fair price for that property.
And she says the agency does look at changes in the market. The National Mining Association's Katie Sweeney adds that the process works. She says BLM's secrecy helps control the prices.
So it's the fact that the government is the only one that knows how they're valuing that coal, we believe is a check on the fact that there is often not more than one bidder.
Sanzillo, the financial analyst, says that's not enough of a check on the program and names a recent Department of Interior report that also found flaws in the process.
There's no competition. The appraisals by all accounts, including the Inspector General for DOI, are flawed. And there's been no audit in 30 years. So there's no accountability for the program, no oversight.
The report he mentions makes clear that even a 1 cent per ton undervaluation in the fair market value calculation for a sale can result in millions of dollars of lost revenues. And Sanzillo says the market itself is as good an indicator as any that BLM's fair market value estimates are not accurate. He gives the example of Cloud Peak Energy after a recent tract acquisition.
It got a tract of coal. It got it for below fair market value. The markets are not stupid. The analysts understand. They stated so in the newspapers, and the stock price went up. That's what happens when a company gets an undervalued asset. The company actually is worth more now. If you have a real fair market value, the net impact on a stock value should be zero.
Squillaci and Sanzillo equate what they see as the too low pricing of federally owned coal with a subsidy to coal companies. Sanzillo says the U.S. has lost out on $29 billion in the past 30 years because of this practice. The Inspector General's report put those potential losses at $60 million for recent lease sales. The issue is perhaps all the more alarming as exports to Asia increase. Since then, the U.S. government would be subsidizing coal for Asia. The BLM's Newman says that's overstating what's actually happening.
What the export demand is for is for a higher quality BTU. We just haven't seen the level of exports here. It's generally been about 1% of the coal.
Still, with high prices abroad, that small percentage of exports sometimes makes up a much more significant piece of the revenues for certain operators. And, by the way, exported coal prices are excluded from the appraisal process. Again, Sam Zillow.
I talk to the industry all the time. They don't agree with us, but I have to tell you, I am a person who has been involved investing, you know, billions of dollars. I'm not quite sure that they understand what they're doing.
Sam Zillow says Wyoming, with its high production in the Powder River Basin, is a linchpin in any discussions about changing the system. And he says now's the time to do it, as the coal industry itself restructures and reevaluates this brave new coal world. But at a recent coal lease sale, the BLM received even less bids than usual. Zero. What Squillace and Sanzillo argue is below fair market value wasn't low enough for companies being cautious in the struggling coal market. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
In September, a congressional subcommittee will hold a hearing in Casper as Congress takes another crack at reforming the Endangered Species Act. Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis has for years been supportive of reforming the ESA. While she's quick to acknowledge that it has been a good law, Lummis is frustrated that once something gets on the endangered species list, it rarely comes off.
It could use some fine-tuning to make it work better. And now we're seeing, as it has had tremendous impacts in western states where there's a lot of federal land or public land. It's now moving east into states that are predominantly private land. And so we're seeing impacts of the act in areas that previously weren't impacted. That includes Texas with the lesser prairie chicken. It includes Missouri. These states are now seeing the heavy hand of a law that has not only lapsed its authorization, but could use some change. So that's what we're hoping to address.
A lot of successes with the Endangered Species Act. Bald eagle obviously jumps at everyone.
Absolutely. You know,
certainly some things with the grizzly bear that we've seen. In your view, though, what's wrong with it?
Okay. No question that the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, has had beneficial aspects to it with regard to restoring populations that really were headed for extinction. Nevertheless, there are also examples of a good law run amok. That's where we really have to focus. We cannot allow subspecies of certain plants to prevent the interaction of humans in an area simply because a subspecies has been identified there. And especially when those species are thriving elsewhere in our country. So there has to be some common sense applied to the Endangered Species Act, and we've passed that point. Furthermore, so much of the Endangered Species Act's implementation has actually been formed by court cases rather than by policymakers, that it's time to revisit it.
And so you're going to have a hearing in Casper on this?
That is correct. I am co-chairing an Endangered Species Act working group with Representative Doc Hastings, who is a member of Congress from the state of Washington. He is also the current chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee. And we will be holding a hearing in Casper on September 4th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oil and Gas Commission hearing room in Casper. Then the next day we'll be in Billings, Montana to have a hearing up there. We're gathering information. We're meeting with people about their current experiences with the Endangered Species Act, the rules and regs that have been passed to implement it, and more importantly, the court cases that have influenced the manner in which it is implemented today. Our goal is not to repeal the Endangered Species Act. Far from it. Our goal is to make the Endangered Species Act work. And we have a law where only 1% of the species that have been listed have actually been delisted. To me, that indicates a law that is failing in its ultimate goal, which is to list species, recover them, and then delist them. The problem is, once a species is listed, it can almost never get off the list, because even if recovery levels are met for that species, attempts to delist it and recognize and celebrate its recovery are met with court challenges.
And I'm curious how you resolve that, because we can use the grizzly bear as an example. Certainly was recommended to be removed from the list, and then we had a court case, and now we're still sorting that out a few years later. I mean, how do you get past that legal aspect?
Moving the goalposts after the goal that was set initially for what constitutes recovery is a big problem. So what I think we need to do is make sure that once we identify a species that is a candidate for listing, that we identify what it means to have a recovery of that species, and then don't move the goalpost over time. Retain that goalpost and allow the scientists to determine when that goal has been met, not the litigators, and then delist it and, you know, have a glass of Prosecco, celebrate.
So you would have scientists look at it, maybe have that peer reviewed before, and then maybe once that's done.
And peer review is very important. I think we need not only non-government scientists and government scientists looking at what constitutes a recovery, but also both government and non-government scientists, a peer-reviewed process to determine when recovery has been met, and keep that at the administrative level rather than a subject of constant litigation.
The hearing takes place September 4th at the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission in Casper.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Wyoming's new Director of Education, Rich Crandall. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's newly appointed Director of Education, Rich Crandall, is busy getting acquainted with Wyoming's education system. Crandall began his new duties August 1st. He was heavily involved in education as a politician in Arizona, and he's now running the Wyoming Department of Education and working with legislators to implement education policy in this state. Lawmakers voted to remove those powers from State Superintendent of Public Instruction Cindy Hill. Crandall is focused on what he calls best practices, or the best ways to improve education. We begin by discussing Wyoming's efforts to improve accountability in education.
Wyoming made a smart decision, I think, a few years ago to go with an ACT suite. That's the Explore plan and the ACT exams. And the reason I'm a big fan of those, or the College Board assessments, is that it allows you to compare yourself across state lines. The danger with only having a state assessment is that it is just you comparing yourselves to yourselves. And that's got its pluses and its minuses for that. So that's the big positive. When you talk about some tweaks that need to take place, the tweaks that Wyoming needs to make are really the same tweaks that many, many, many states need to make. And that's, let's just talk logistics for a second. When you take your exam in March or April, those poor students and teachers don't get the results back till August, September. So if you look at the kind of the use of time and the use of resources, we take an exam the end of March, beginning of April, we get the results back in August. If we were able to get those results back in 2 to 3 weeks, there's a good 6 weeks of school left where we could intervene on specific targeted areas for students. And then for those students who choose to go to summer school or have the choice made for them, you could have a customized intervention for the weaknesses based on their assessments. Right now, we're not able to do that because we don't find out their weaknesses till they've moved on to the next grade. So that's one of the big things I'd like to see change.
Is there any, I've heard this pitched in the past here before, is there any thought about like a mid-semester or a mid-year type of test?
There's lots of discussion about formative assessments, and the beauty of technology nowadays and adaptive learning, personalized instruction, blended learning, it goes by really a lot of different names, is the ability for a teacher to get feedback all the time. It could be daily, it could be weekly, it could be monthly, quarterly, semesters. But that is key to, you just can't wait till the end of the school year, take one exam and say, huh, how did we do this year?
Rich Crandall visiting with us. He's the new director of education. The other thing about accountability is, of course, taking a look at individual schools and seeing how they're doing. One of the tricky things for me as I've been following this discussion is wondering how you make that all work and how you develop improvement when you have a local control state like we have. Any thoughts there?
Local control is good when you have leadership, a great school board like there in Cheyenne, a superintendent who recognizes their strengths and their weaknesses and then has a plan. Local control can be a little bit of a challenge sometimes when people get content or they don't realize how they're doing compared to others. But I'm a huge local control fan. We've got to support the districts with the resources they need to succeed, but we also have to make sure that they are aiming high enough, that they're aspirational about where they want their kids to be 5-10 years from now.
I'm curious your thoughts on the graduation rate issue, just kind of tying in with all of that. One of the concerns, obviously, is you've got, especially in certain districts where maybe the oil and gas development have been going on, that you've had a higher dropout rate than the state would like. That's frequently brought up by legislators. How do you attack that?
5 years ago, the superintendent of the Phoenix Union School District, 13 high schools, that's the entire district, he comes in and he finds out within the first 2 weeks that the district has two goals, and those goals are to lower the dropout rate and to minimize the police points of contact on campus. And immediately he begins a crusade among all the students and the parents, and his theme is, you do not achieve greatness by focusing on minimizing the negative. Your goals can't be to minimize the negative. So if your goal is to focus strictly on the dropout rate, the challenge is you're ignoring those 76%, 77% of the students who are there and who do graduate. What's their goal? What's their aspiration? So here's what you do. You aim high. You have a college and career ready focus, rigor. You provide opportunities for engagement, and that includes sports and music and career and technical education courses, that exciting engagement that keeps students excited to come to school. And as you focus on those things, guess what a byproduct is? A lower dropout rate, a higher graduation rate. In Phoenix, fewer police points of contact. And the superintendent proved that over the last 5 years as he focused on the high. He was able to achieve those other things.
Is this a situation where then you'd have to meet with individual districts and express this, or can you do this?
No, but it has to be the individual district. So I've been traveling the state, met with the brand new superintendent of Rock Springs, a guy named Matthew Neal, and then Superintendent Neal shows me into his office where he has several of his cabinet members, and they're having this big brainstorm session about principals and creating a principal leadership academy. I mean, the energy in the room was incredible. You don't get that from sitting in an office here at the Department of Education. You can't experience that. I now also know what some specific goals are that Rock Springs has. I had the same chance last week to just drop in on the Rollins superintendent, new guy Fletcher over there. That's what it's going to take to... you can't come in and set statewide goals because, one, you ignore local control, and two, a statewide goal ignores the individuality of communities and the different needs. There are some districts that just knock it out of the park. Their dropout rate is 2%, and then there's some where it's 30%. You can't treat them similarly.
Maybe one last topic for you before I let you go. I've certainly read up on you and know about your role in distance education, distance learning. Obviously, this could be We're engaging in that right now in the state, but it's something that I think a lot of people see has huge possibilities in Wyoming. I mean, what is realistic for the state, and in what ways might that improve education in some of these areas?
That's a great conversation right there. And what I love about Wyoming, literally, Wyoming is poised to be a breakout state when it comes to, I'm going to call it blended learning, not distance learning. When people hear that term, they typically think of the full-time virtual schools, a student stays at home, things like that. My big passion is the blended learning. You take a fantastic teacher and you supplement the, let's call it the weaknesses of a student with technology, especially adaptive learning. But that ability to fill in some gaps with technology, all being orchestrated by a great teacher, that's the future of education in the U.S. And I honestly think Wyoming could lead the country in that area because of the investment in infrastructure that legislators, previous governors, current Governor Mead have made that just set us up for success.
We will talk more about that in the future. Rich Crandall, a pleasure and welcome to Wyoming, and thank you for joining us in Open Spaces.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much. Looking forward to talking in the future.
The University of Wyoming will kick off a new school year on Monday. It's an exciting time for incoming freshmen, but the college years bring new freedoms as well as new risks. UW's Stop Violence program offers crisis intervention and support for anyone on campus who's been affected by sexual assault, relationship violence, or stalking, and works to educate students about the issues. I spoke with UW's new Stop Violence coordinator, Megan Selheim, about what new students should bear in mind for the coming school year.
For women especially, they are most at risk between the ages of 16 and 24, both for sexual assault and for non-fatal partner violence. Men, I think because of some of the social dynamics that underlie these crimes, are more likely to be victimized, at least sexually assaulted or raped, when they're children. So some people are coming to the university already as a survivor. They show up day one, and they've already had to live through some of this. But we do have a significant percentage of the population where if something happens to them, it happens while they're at the university. When we talk about sexual violence, and especially when we're talking about sexual assault and rape, the dynamic that we're starting to recognize as the most prevalent is that there's a very, very small percentage of perpetrators who intentionally look for people to take advantage of. And they're looking for people who they think are less likely to report that something happened to them, maybe are more vulnerable in some way. And I think for that reason, freshmen and sophomores may be at a higher risk simply because they're relatively new. They want to fit in. They want to make a name for themselves and really make a difference while they're at the university. And these offenders look to take advantage of that. But generally, I think there's risk the whole time you're at the university, unfortunately. So we work with anyone at any stage.
What should people bear in mind as far as safety and what's available for them?
I think the most important thing in terms of safety is that we need to look out for each other. People who are assaulted, people who are in abusive relationships or who are dealing with stalking are not responsible for what happens to them. It's like any other crime. Someone else found them, decided they would be a target, and then either tried or successfully perpetrated a crime against that person. And when we're looking at the dynamics of sexual assault, relationship violence, and stalking, one of the primary tools, I guess, that perpetrators use is isolation. So trying to create some distance between the person that they want to hurt and that person's support system, whether that's literally separating them from their friends at a party or trying to create some friction between that person and their friends over the course of their relationship. They're trying to isolate that person from the people who care about them. And so I think in terms of safety, one of the most important things that we all can do is try to prevent that from happening. If you're out with friends, stick together, whether that means everyone stays at the party later than they want to or everyone leaves a little earlier than they want to. If you know someone who just started dating another person and it seems like they're starting to disappear off the radar, do what you can to maintain that contact. Invite them to come out, stop by their place and say, hey, call them regularly just to try and maintain some connection, because isolation is one of the most dangerous components of these crimes that we see. The other thing I would say both to students and to parents, is that if something were to happen, it's not the person's fault who was hurt. And we can't look at their behavior or their environment for answers. We have to look at the perpetrator, and we have to ask the perpetrator or force the perpetrator to take responsibility for their actions. So if someone reaches out to you, a friend reaches out, your child reaches out and says, this happened to me, the best way to respond is supportive, believe what they're telling you, and get them connected if you can to resources. Anyone's welcome to call me. I'll talk to anyone who calls me or comes by my office. We have a couple other resources on campus that are great. University Police Department has been incredibly supportive and a really great partner in trying to address the violence on campus. University Counseling Center is always available to students who want to talk about anything. They're a wonderful resource. I feel that most of the faculty and staff, residence assistants, everyone on campus, we are a community here. We really think about violence on campus as a community issue. We want the entire community to recognize that we all have a role to play. We all have the responsibility to keep each other safe and to make campus a place where we don't tolerate this type of violence. And so if any students want to get more involved than they already have been in trying to do that work, we have a couple RSOs that they can get involved in. We obviously have the programs we do on campus. I would just encourage anyone who has an interest to get in touch with me. And if we're not the best fit, we can find something for them to do to help make campus safer.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you.
Megan Selheim is the Stop Violence Program Coordinator at UW. She welcomes calls from anyone on campus who needs help or is just looking for more information. She can be reached at 766-3296 or at stopviolence@uwyo.edu.
When we come back, we'll have stories on small business funding and our latest in our Upstart series. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. It has never been easy to start a small business or to keep it going. Acquiring startup money is always one of the challenges. In Wyoming specifically, officials say they want to develop more businesses, but unless you're a technology company, it can be difficult to find the necessary support. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Laramie Economic Development Director Dan Furphy says funding small businesses is scary for lenders.
The failure rate is extremely high. I think it's something along the lines of 80% fail within the first 2 years. So what that means is banks and others who are putting their capital into a business have to be very conservative in making sure they're not risking their depositors' money, et cetera.
Furphy spent most of his career as a banker, and he says the general reason small businesses fail is that business plans do not account for early hurdles, including the slow times.
Late January through March and April, it's a tough time to do business in Laramie. People have spent their money, they're holding tight to their purse strings, and so you've got to be able to survive those slow periods of time. And so you've got to have enough capital to support your business through those periods.
The Wyoming Business Council has worked hard to help a number of small businesses get started and offers an array of support to not only help them stay in business and grow. But Bob Jensen, the CEO, also admits that not all small businesses are equal. He says there does seem to be more support for unique or high-tech businesses, and he agrees that the traditional retail business owner can have a tough time getting started. But he also maintains that hurdles can be overcome. Jensen says those interested in starting new businesses need to find a way to make themselves known to potential investors or to those who provide loans. Working in a specific business for a long time or being active in local organizations can help.
If you are visible and have demonstrated your credibility in almost any circumstance, that's an advantage for you in terms of trying to, you know, get out in front of people that have resources that might be beneficial to fund your business.
This is inside Gateway Fuels and Gateway Liquors at the corner of Highways 230 and 130 in Laramie. It features a gas station, this convenience store, and an adjoining liquor store. It's been open for a little over a year. The three partners are all in their mid-30s with Laramie business backgrounds. Rajiv Patel's family owns and operates hotels and owns property. He says without those local connections, it might have been tough to get funding.
It's having that local bank that knows my family, knows what I'm about, that gets my foot in the door where other banks wouldn't even bother.
Patel also credits his father's advice to be active in nonprofits and local organizations for helping him gain credibility for the project.
And honestly, that's what helped me out tremendously when I decided to do my own business. And like I keep saying that they know me, it was because of that, my work through those boards and the nonprofits, that people really get to know who you are.
So Patel was able to get funding, but there are some unforeseen costs. Sometimes local communities want you to rebuild roads, improve the local infrastructure, or want you to even change your building plans. Patel laughs and says it was an education working with the city of Laramie and the Wyoming Department of Transportation.
We knew we had to talk to Wyodot. We knew we had to talk to the city of Laramie. We didn't realize there were going to be these huge walls that we had to climb constantly to get past these entities.
John Benson runs UW's Wyoming Technology Business Center, a business incubator. He's proud to say that nobody who's graduated from the center has ever gone bankrupt. Benson says if you want to start a small business, you should focus on something that provides a product to another business versus providing a product for a consumer.
If you're solving a problem for another business, then I can figure out what's going to cause you to buy. And in business-to-consumer companies, it's tougher. It's tougher to figure out what the values and the needs are of the people you're trying to sell to.
But Benson says they have had companies that cater to consumers, but they take a unique approach.
We just graduated a company called Tiger Tree, and they sell to people who have problems with beetles killing their trees. And the neat thing about that business is that so we can spray your tree and it won't die, but we're going to have to spray it again next year. So it's like you get continuing revenue.
Benson says another key is to avoid loans. He says they can take a long time to pay off and will require you to have a lot of success right away. Benson says it is always better to raise your own money. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A new group is convinced that with a little coaching, Jackson Hole can become the Silicon Valley of the Rockies. In fact, this ad hoc group has taken the name Silicon Cooler. They're convinced that within the state, the investors exist to help grow more startup businesses. But what's lacking is a venue for investors and entrepreneurs to meet. The possible solution is known as Pitch Day. Rebecca Huntington reports.
My name is John Pansevich, and I'm a co-founder of MusicLessons.com.
My name is Matthew Goransky. I'm with Thorium Manufactured Reactors, and we build nuclear power plants.
Landon Wiedenman, and I pitch an artificial intelligence health management system.
In total, seven entrepreneurs appeared at the invitation-only Pitch Day in an effort to attract investors. Silicon Cooler is a diverse group with experience ranging from Wall Street to Silicon Valley. Everyone is seated inside a fancy barn, built for events, not horses, at the exclusive Shooting Star Golf Club in Teton Village. Just getting in the door is a coup. Todd Grouse has been working for 3 years on his patented device that he calls the Biopacker.
Think about this. Homeowners pay to seed a crop, and then they pay to maintain a crop, and then they pay to harvest a crop, and then it's dumped on the ground to waste.
Grouse says his machine can turn lawn leftovers into feed for cows, pigs, chickens, and other livestock. And that means turning grass into cash. But to even get in the door, Grouse had to undergo a competitive application process. Once selected, he then faced rigorous rounds of coaching to polish his business plan and presentation style.
They were brutally honest when I would bring in and talk about my business plan or my slides or my presentation. I mean, if it stunk, they told me it stunk.
That kind of feedback was hard to hear.
The first time I came away, I was really, really beat down. I was actually angry because I couldn't believe they tore me apart the way they did. But I went back to the drawing board and took their suggestions and just continued to make it better and better and better, and here I am today.
Today, his company is ready to launch. As soon as he gets the capital, Pitch Day feels a little like reality TV. The pitchers stand at a podium with a screen behind them displaying slides of their business plan.
They face a room full of potential investors and a panel of experts who scribble notes and ask questions. Eric Green is pitching his Dust Cutter Beverage Company, which sells bottled lemonade. The idea comes from his family's Jackson Hole Dude Ranch days, when guests would return from trail rides and cut the dust with a glass of homemade lemonade.
We've already completed two rounds of financing totaling $400,000, and we need to raise $1 million to fund further expansion.
The panelists grill Green, with questions ranging from how this could become a national brand, opportunities to build partnerships, and business margins. The goal is to make the business plan more attractive and more viable. Panelist J.J. Healy, a former vice president of corporate development at Yahoo and a partner in a venture capital firm, says that in Wyoming, a key barrier to launching startup businesses is geography.
It's a lack of connection. I live part-time here and part-time in San Francisco. And in Silicon Valley, the connections between entrepreneurs, lawyers, venture guys, education is all within miles. Here, it's within the state. So you really have to get the right people in the right room to be able to know what's going on and to know what the opportunities are in the state.
Last year, six companies made pitches. Venture capitalist Bob Grady invested in one of those companies, and he's interested again this year.
I'm actually going to go visit three or four of the companies right now.
Grady says the state lacks venture capitalists and the other business expertise it takes to foster new businesses. But that's beginning to change.
But I think it's growing in places like Jackson, in places like Laramie and Cheyenne.
Indeed, Story Clark, founder of a travel app that launched on iTunes last year, says she's looking for more than just capital at pitch day.
I could use some really, really smart guys who are watching their money, or women, who are watching their money and make sure it's spent in the best possible way. I've got a great team, but I need to grow it much greater than it is currently.
And that's where Silicon Cooler comes in. The group hopes to cultivate the kind of business environment in Jackson Hole that will help entrepreneurs like Clark grow their companies. Although they're just getting started, Silicon Cooler members say events like Pitch Day are already making a difference. One company that secured investors at Pitch Day last year reported increasing sales from $12,000 to $60,000 in a year. They also got an experienced business leader to join their board and have secured two more years of funding to keep growing. In addition to Pitch Day, the group offers popular monthly gatherings, online directories, and intensive training through a new startup institute to nurture entrepreneurs and small businesses year-round. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
Now for the latest edition in our occasional series, Upstarts. We'll hear from a stay-at-home mom who launched a multimedia publishing company from her kitchen table in Laramie. Katie Heim is the owner and editor of three high-quality magazines that focus on life in and across the Cowboy State. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
The door to Katie Heim's publishing headquarters is guarded by Daisy, the Maltese Yorkie mix.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Heim and her husband Levi plan and publish Wyoming Weddings, Wyoming Lifestyle, and Wyovore magazines in their sunny kitchen, the walls lined with their children's artwork. Katie is a Wyoming native and says the job is a great fit for her.
I love connecting with people. I really, really do. And I love learning about what people think about our state. And I love learning about personalities and the differences in our state. And when I learn all those things, it makes me feel even more connected and more of a cheerleader for Wyoming, because it is just such a neat place to live.
The publishing business is a second job for Heim and her husband. He's a geologist who's on the road a lot. Heim has always loved writing, but pursued a practical career as a medical sonographer. She switched to part-time work after the birth of her second child, but she got antsy sitting at home and wanted to start her own business. After selling cosmetics out of the house for a while, she heard that a wedding guide in the state had folded, leaving a void in the local bridal publishing market, and she pounced. Haim and her husband poured their savings into creating Wyoming Weddings, a free annual bridal planning guide. Unlike national wedding magazines, her wedding guide would help Wyoming brides prepare for weather and wind, a limited number of venues, and manage relationships with vendors in the state.
It is a smile and handshake state, and it is a state that works very much on personal connections, and those things make a wedding a very special day.
Haim writes many of the articles herself, but she also hired contract writers, photographers, and a designer, and released the first issue in January of 2009. Haim's husband handles the website. Haim also tracks down dozens of advertisers and personally distributes the magazine to hundreds of locations across the state.
Because, you know, and you, if like,
for yeah. weddings work yeah. specifically, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Preparing for the 2014 issue, Haim interviews Rich and Stephanie Osborne, who own Ardent Photography in Laramie. They're helping her compile a list of tips for choosing a wedding photographer. Stephanie remembers meeting Haim at a bridal expo several years ago and being impressed by her energy.
I mean, Katie's one of the hardest workers that we know. I would say that, like, she multitasks and keeps herself busy and works so hard for her advertisers. And so you really feel comfortable putting in an investment for her because you know that she's going to make it pay off. If anybody can do it, then she'll do it because she works so hard.
Since 2009, the magazine has grown in size and quality, now featuring large, colorful photo spreads on thick, glossy pages. 8,000 copies went around the state this year, and Haim plans to print 10,000 in 2014.
Hello?
But Haim had energy to spare and set about developing a free quarterly magazine covering more Wyoming stories. Wyoming Lifestyle Magazine first appeared in 2010. It profiles unique homes and interesting people, highlights University of Wyoming sports, and offers health tips. Haim recalls one of her favorite stories in which she interviewed the Sunbonnet Gals in Torrington.
They make, they sew sunbonnets once a week in the senior center. It's the cutest thing. And they actually use a real honest to God pattern from the Oregon Trail days. And it's so unique that they are not allowed to share it. They keep it under lock and key.
Haim estimates that Wyoming Lifestyle has about 35,000 readers in print and online. But with even more energy to spare, she created WyoVore in 2011. That annual magazine targets people outside of Wyoming and features Western-style tourist spots, restaurants, and hotels around the state. 2,000 issues out a year at about $5 a pop. Haim says it's especially popular in Italy, home of the spaghetti Western. This year, Cody's Chamberlain Inn was featured in a four-page article with photos highlighting the bright, cozy building and grounds. General Manager Kelly Deal Statton says she was impressed by the quality of the spread and was happy to find that WyoVore targets the very same people the inn hopes to entice.
You know, obviously, any exposure we can get outside of the state or inside the state is great. And the article that was written about us is much more in-depth than any sort of advertising we could do.
Haim says she would like to continue growing the magazine business when her kids get older. As it is, she handles most of the advertising, writing, editing, and distribution herself, and she estimates she works about 60 hours a week. That doesn't include her part-time sonography job. Haim says the magazines are turning some profit, but she's not seeing the revenues just yet.
And sometimes when you're 3 or 4 years into it and you're working on paying off that debt and you haven't paid yourself yet and you're sitting up at midnight and you look awful and you're like, oh my God, why am I doing this?
But Haim says positive feedback from readers gets her through the hard days and energizes her. She knows the publishing industry nationwide is in a rocky state, but she says it's worth it to take a chance on what you really love. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
Coming up, Wyoming painter Catherine Turner joins us. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Wyoming landscape painter Catherine Turner grew up on the Triangle X Ranch in Grand Teton National Park, surrounded by dramatic views of her favorite subject, the Tetons. And in her words, she spent the past 20 years trying to do them justice.
And they are challenging. And what makes them challenging is they're always changing with the light, with the seasons, with the way the clouds move over them, obscuring them, changing the shadows. So they provide a lifetime of material.
Catherine Turner's new exhibition, All in One Breath, opened in the past week at Trio Fine Art in Jackson. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reached her at the gallery.
What does a painting tell us that just looking at nature might not?
Well, I'm a big believer that the human spirit needs both nature and artistic expression. I feel really fortunate to be at the intersection of those places. And so I feel like my role as an artist is to capture that fleeting moment on canvas so that someone who looks at my paintings might experience the same magic.
You're talking about feelings?
It's always about feelings with me. Yeah, it's emotional communication that I think that art can do in a really special way.
I guess this probably ties in that you do a lot of your work is impressionistic, and so you're not entirely tied to literal realism.
My work is about painting the essence of something, so there's a great deal of editing. I think that's one of the hardest things as a landscape painter is to decide what to take out. And I think that the more distilled my paintings are, the more I've isolated what it is that I'm trying to say, the more room there is for interpretation of the viewer. And then a conversation begins with the viewer and the painting. I think that that room for interpretation is really critical for a piece to be interesting.
How might that conversation go?
Well, this is what I've heard. When people look at my paintings, there's a sense of wonder. There's a certain amount of mystery. They look at a brush stroke and they think, maybe that's a creek, or maybe it's a flock of birds, and it gets them to tap into their own memory bank and well of experience that they've had, and then they become connected to the image.
And it might be different for each person.
Exactly, as it should be.
You're using a lot of these words that have maybe a religious connotation is too strong, but you're saying human spirit, wonder, mystery. And you have this new exhibition that's just opened. And in the description of that exhibition, you say it's inspired by the spirit of unity and interconnectedness. So what are these ideas and values, and what do they have to do with paintings?
I'd like to add the word spirituality. I think that certainly for me, the experience of the landscape in a place like Jackson in Wyoming taps into a universal sense of spirituality, which is to say something greater than ourselves, but also something that we feel intricately a part of. And as a painter, when I'm in the landscape, I feel a part of something bigger. And that in and of itself starts the conversation of spirituality. I really see when I'm out painting how interconnected everything is. And so I try and reflect that in my paintings. I try and create paintings that connect with the viewer, but also visually are very harmonious and coherent images.
It sounds like you have quite a lot of reverence for your subject, the Tetons.
That's why I started painting. At a very young age, I realized that I had a profound and deep appreciation for being as fortunate as I was to be born in Jackson. And I was grateful to find painting early on as a way of expressing that gratitude and appreciation for the beauty of the landscape.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk, and I hope that the exhibition is a great success.
This was great fun, Micah. Thank you for having me.
That was Micah Schweitzer speaking with artist Catherine Turner. Her new exhibition, All in One Breath, opened this past week at the Trio Fine Art Gallery in Jackson. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again or listen to individual segments, go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to submit comments about our stories on that website, and we also invite you to become a fan of our Facebook page called Wyoming Public Radio News, and you can also follow all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.